Blog Talk Radio.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge mini episode number 484. This is FDH Managing Partner Rick Morris coming at you today with the continuation of one of our fondest traditions in the FDH Lounge. I believe this is our sixth annual edition of this segment. We've been doing it, I believe, going back continuously to 2009. It's our analysis of the 2014/15 fall TV season, and we're going to be breaking it down with, of course, two of our favorite recurring FDH Lounge dignitaries, my good friend Simon Applebaum from Tomorrow Will Be Televised, the great blog and podcast that he does, as well as good friend Lloyd Carroll from the Queen's Chronicle, from a number of different other publications in New York that are not immediately coming to mind, but Lloyd writes for an entire flurry of such publications. I see that he's on the phone lines now. He can help me in revising and extending that plug. Queen's Chronicle, Good Times Magazine, I believe, Lloyd, right?
Those are the flagships, but yes, New York Sports Day, NYSportsDay.com, Latino Sports, we go for every demographic here. City Sports Report's a new one for me, where I work with Darrell Johnson, one of really the terrific up-and-coming New York City journalists. We have New York Sports Examiner. I tell you, just Google me, and we're there. BrooklynFans.com for all you Brooklyn hipsters out there. So, yeah, we try to get the word out there.
It is a whirlwind, to be sure, but it's always a whirlwind having you on the show, and again, pairing you up with the great Simon Applebaum, my other friend on the phone lines here from Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Simon, so good to have you back on. We always benefit from your very thoughtful analysis on these segments. Pleasure to have you as well.
It is a pleasure, Rick, and great to be back with Lloyd. And since Lloyd took the revising cue, let me do some revising on my own. Our show, Tomorrow Will Be Televised, is now in its eighth year on the air. We're on Mondays and Fridays at 3 o'clock Eastern, noon Pacific on Blog Talk Radio. And since March, we have been televised. We are now the first internet radio podcast that is simulcast live on television. We're on Brooklyn Independent Media. It's a wonderful cable channel. If you have Verizon Fios throughout New York City, you can get it. I think it's like channel 50-something. And in Brooklyn, it's on Time Warner Cable, Cablevision Systems, RCN, on all the cable systems in Brooklyn. And we're also available nationally in replay on Vimeo.com at Vimeo.com/BKNewMedia. So since our fifth annual thing doing the fall TV season, we've come a long way in terms of being televised. But it's great to be back with both of you.
Great.
Oh,
hey, by the way,
awesome.
Rick, I know we're here to talk, you know, about the primetime lineup, but I figure I can't resist this since you're in Cleveland. They had that little event yesterday at the Quicken Loans Arena, which actually was a TV event. Drew 4 million viewers, I believe, on TNT nationally. And
yes.
What I'm trying to figure out is it's a regular season game, and the fact that LeBron was on the losing team didn't have a big night. Do you think that if people were just going a little crazy here, expecting him to score like 75 points or something, that the man, you know, he's played in so many championship games, he's got a long season ahead of him, that do you think that perhaps people are being a little hard on LeBron and maybe the TV audience was last night?
Hard to say. It's a historical event when you look at, I mean, a lot of people were comparing it to the different circumstances of Michael Jordan coming back. He had two chapters to his career with the Chicago Bulls, albeit his hiatus was under far, far different circumstances.
Sure.
But he had the whole thing of coming back as well. And anytime you have that second chapter opening unexpectedly, you're going to have a lot of chaos and anticipation that goes along with it. Of course, as you mentioned, in my hometown of Cleveland, Ohio, where everyone is very, very excited about the new and improved Cleveland Cavaliers. By the way, I can't let this observation that I had go without being put out there. As far as what Simon was saying, truly, if you are a listener of or a viewer now of Tomorrow Will Be Televised, it is today that will be televised because you're able to catch that show in different formats. So I'm glad that we were able to put that in there, Simon, that you know, the future is now, as it were, when it comes to your show being televised.
Yes, it certainly is. And working with the Brooklyn Independent Media people has been just fantastic. The quality of the show is really upgraded. We can now do in-studio guests. We can run clips of shows and interactive services and other such TV ventures. We're doing new features. The Brooklyn Independent Media people are fantastic to work with, and they can't be happier with the way the show's going.
Well, it is a tremendous, tremendous show. You learn a lot from listening to it. It's entertaining to hear the thought processes of the people that you talk to on there. I certainly cannot recommend it highly enough. That's one of the reasons you can find it on the Ultimate Links page at the FDHLounge.com. Just go down to the entertainment section on there, and you will find it. And you will find it signified in there, as we do, have them color-coded so that any of the members of the 21st Century Media Alliance pop out a little bit more at you for easier ability to locate. Just look for Tomorrow Will Be Televised down there, and all the information for the show is right there. We've got a lot to talk about, guys, in terms of taking a look at the fall TV season, and we've had the benefit of seeing this particular campaign get underway. It's certainly, once you get past the point of the World Series, you can really kind of start to draw some kind of firm notes in your head on how things are playing out and everything. So I'd like to just start it on a more general note, and I'll start with you, Simon, on how the season is playing out relative to your expectations going in. And that could be anything you want it to be, from how the new shows, how much rope is being given to them, how they performed in the ratings, to any of the favorites from previous years, how they're holding up. Any thoughts that you think are the most important right now in your head as far as the landscape?
Well, you said it, Rick. The new network shows, broadcast shows, are getting maybe the most rope they've ever had in a long time. And there are a couple factors behind it. One of them is the broadcast network executives are being less itchy on the trigger finger. And that's because of digital video recorders and video on demand. They want to see whether the audience watching these shows on replay on their DVRs, which half the nation's households in the United States have, and video on demand on cable and satellite, how much that compensates for the loss of live audience. That's why, compared to previous years, we're right around 4 or 5 weeks in, 4 or 5 shows would easily be canceled. There's only been one, Manhattan Love Story on ABC. There are certainly quite a lot on the bubble, on the chopping block. So that's one issue. Another one is Thursday Night Football. I think some people wanted to wait to see how CBS did first with that, and then following Thursday Night Football, where they don't have it, just NFL Network, to see how things settle out. And like you said, after the World Series, which, by the way, was the lowest World Series on broadcast television history. And third, I think there is a lot of fascination with just how the DVR ratings themselves go, whether people want to see live by 3 audience or live by 7 or whatever. There's nobody knows yet how that will settle. But a couple of things are clear. One is Shonda Rhimes is the first woman of color to program a night of primetime television on broadcast television on ABC Thursday night, and it is working. Grey's Anatomy is getting the best ratings ABC has had on Thursday nights at 8 o'clock in years. Scandal is doing super at 9. How to Get with Murder, certainly one of the top new shows of the year, because that's number one. Second, CBS is off and running. Madam Secretary, I think, has been the big sleeper of the year so far. I think a lot of people are very surprised at how successful that is on Sunday nights opposite The Walking Dead and Sunday Night Football and so on. Scorpion has come off pretty well, even when Big Bang Theory is not the lead-in. Stalker is holding up okay, even though it's winning its time period. That may be one show that may be on the chopping block, depending on how the ratings settle. And so far, I think CBS is the big winner. The other thing that's very clear, Fox is in big, big trouble. Nothing seems to be working, including the World Series. Utopia, which you got to give them credit for in terms of taking a big gamble on it, started with 3 episodes the first week, 2 the second, 3rd week following. It's already been down to 1 week. The ratings are minuscule. Red Band Society, which has gotten fair reviews, not doing well. And Mulaney and Brooklyn Nine-Nine not doing great on Sunday night. The other thing that's interesting is the CW is having the best ratings it's had ever. Jane the Virgin, one of the most acclaimed shows of the year. The Flash, which Lori and I thought was one of the best pilots shown during the upfront season back in the spring, doing great. And now, believe it or not, CW is beating Fox in the Tuesday night ratings. And who would have ever thought that?
That is truly, truly amazing. I want to put basically the same question to you, Lloyd, with the one proviso. As I was telling Simon off air, I know that You and I both have a big interest in my case. I won't put words in your mouth, in what's going on with Mulaney. So let's hold off on that for a second because I want to talk about that specifically. But aside from that, any of your other big impressions for the season thus far?
You know, I'm going to almost confess here that I've not gotten a chance to watch as many of the new shows, probably as you just mentioned, all these sporting events that Simon just listed, Thursday Night Football and other issues. I have to say that Scorpion doesn't surprise me. I can't believe Catherine McPhee could actually be in a hit show, but CBS does well with those egg-heady kind of shows. They seem to have that niche. Either they're good at these, what do they call, the crime procedurals, or they seem to have a thing with the Brainiac angle. In this case, instead of Big Bang Theory, where they play for comedy, it's played for adventure. And I guess the NCIS, I don't think I'm going to be happy until every city has its own NCIS. I think that's what we need. The Tiffany Network, every city. NCIS Cleveland is coming next year, Rick. No question.
Pop up in a guest role.
there you have it. You know which show I thought NBC was going to do well with it, and it seemed like predetermined to fail, but I thought Bad Judge would get off to a better start. I mean, Bad Teacher, which I actually enjoyed last year with Ari Grainer on CBS, went away pretty quickly. But with Kate Walsh, I thought NBC was really going to do well with that show, and it really wasn't that awful. A couple of episodes I saw, you know, I chuckled. And Simon, is that one of those shows that you think is on the cutting block right now?
I think it's on the chopping block, Lloyd. So is A to Z, which I do like. And to be point of disclosure, we had the creator of the show, Ben Queen, on the program several weeks ago. I like A to Z. I like the leads. It is doing terrible. The whole Thursday night lineup on NBC. It continues to pick up where it left off, which is just terrible ratings all over the board. It's just getting zonked.
Must not see TV, I guess. That's the other one. Now, you said Stalker, because I thought CBS renewed all their dramas, at least through the end of the season.
They have.
Yeah, I mean, let's face it, Dylan, it's not a season. Is Dylan McDermott our new Ted McGinley, basically? Every show he's in, he's going to fail, but they'll keep finding new shows for him?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. By the way, two other things, Rick. With ABC... Mixed bag. On the one hand, give them credit for tremendous diversity. They really stepped it up with the Shonda Rhimes programs, but also Black-ish, which is controversial, but so far holding up and mostly getting good reviews. Cristela, their new Friday night show, is doing better than Last Man Standing, which I'm curious is still standing, believe it or not, although the show, I'm not a big fan of the show. But on the other hand, the Tuesday night lineup is in trouble, big trouble. Marvel Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which I think was the disappointment of last season, continues to be the disappointment this season. It's only on the air because Disney is Marvel, and Marvel is Disney, and that's why ABC has to take the show. But the Tuesday night lineup and the Sunday night lineup is also in big trouble. This may be the last year for Once Upon a Time. Revenge continues to do lousy at 10 o'clock, and Resurrection is, which I liked a lot when it came on mid-season this year, is not doing well now in its second season. The other thing... We may look back on this fall and say that the best new show on television this fall may not be on broadcast, may not be on cable, may not even be on Netflix. I'm talking about Transparent, the new series by Joe Soloway starring Jeffrey Tambor on Amazon. The critics, myself included, are raving. Jeffrey Tambor, who I've admired as a character actor for years since Hill Street Blues in the 1980s, gives the performance of his life. He will certainly be up for Best Comedy Actor Emmy next summer, and I think the show will win a Peabody Award. It's a marvelous program, and it's a tremendous breakthrough for Amazon.
You know, I've actually seen Transparent. I can't believe this. That's exactly the kind of show I probably wouldn't kill myself to watch. Funny part is, what it got a lot of attention for... that is, obviously, Jeffrey Tambor is a transgendered figure. Really is not, to me, the main part of the story. It's the neurotic kids that are the main part of the story. And frankly, you know, I have to say, maybe I'm being hypersensitive, or maybe it's a niche program. I'm kind of surprised that Jewish groups haven't exactly picketed, but certainly expressed some qualms over this, because it really does play to a lot of psychotic Jewish stereotypes. And for this is kind of my take. It's not that it's poorly acted. It is well acted. But, I just am surprised that it hasn't generated that type of buzz.
Well, yeah, that's a very interesting point as well. And, as great as Jeffrey Tambor is, that's the point that's very much in my head as a relatively recent Larry Sanders completist. Reminded once again just how, we think of him typically as more of a comedic actor, and certainly for those of us that enjoyed the Hangover trilogy as well, but getting to show his dramatic chops with that show. Something that's very interesting as well, Bad Judge came up, this is something that I had read about that I found to be very, very intriguing, that apparently the original version of the show, the vision of it that was put out there by some of the guys from Funny or Die, who are some of the key executive producers behind it, that, again, it seemed to get watered down. Maybe the focus groups didn't like it so much, and that it's a thing where they've... it's played down, I think, what might be, pardon term, but maybe the skankiness of the judge a little bit from earlier on, and kind of just made her more of like a stock type TV character. I haven't seen 1 second of it, so I don't know. But Lloyd, that's a criticism I read, is that they watered it down.
I think Kate Walsh is actually, look, it's still going to be primetime NBC. It's not Amazon. It's not HBO. But I think Kate Walsh is pretty fearless. I really did not. I know she's. Was she a Grey Anatomy alum? I think so. Anyway, she's very fearless and gives it her all on this. I'm absolutely impressed with her performance.
And also, the creator of the show left the show. There's been some production problems behind the scenes. The creator left.
It's funny. Here's a term, Simon, when I was growing up, I never heard of it. Now it's become as common as bro from How I Met Your Mother. Showrunner. I never heard this term until 2 years ago. Then it seems like everybody's using that term.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's like one of the great new fabricated words that has become part of the lexicon for television.
Okay, I mean, Lloyd,
I will put the two in a sentence. I think you would be an excellent showrunner, bro.
It's just amazing how...
By the way, gentlemen, speaking of NBC, another big surprise is The Mysteries of Laura. When Lloyd and I first saw this, again at NBC's Upfront at the Javits Center, I think both of us had the same idea. What the are we watching with Deborah Messing? Who is an actress, by the way, I like. But I thought that the plot was awful. I thought the idea of combining cop drama family show was a little bit on the weird side. But guess what? Even though it is third place in the ratings, it is hanging on. And I understand that there has been revamping on the format. Messing is better. The plots are better. And that maybe this may be a big surprise. This may be a show that we all thought was going to be headed for the scrap heap pretty quick. And again, pulled on the chopping block. But it's hanging in.
Yeah, when I saw the pilot, I called it Dirty Harriet. That's that was my take on it.
Well, the commonality there with Deborah Messing, what we were talking about with Kate Walsh, is that, again, actors and actresses, they're only as good as the material that they're given. And I think you guys are right. Both are tremendous actresses. But, again, you're only going to get the best out of them with the right kind of material. And therein lies the eternal struggle. As far as writing that is being done, that's something that I want to bring up as well, as promised, to get to the subject of Mulaney, which, Lloyd, you have been writing about in your columns a little bit here. I am a fan. My partner at FDH, our senior editor, Jason Jones, got me into him as a stand-up comedian, and he and I have both really, really enjoyed watching him on Kroll's show, and Nick Kroll is pretty much my favorite comedian, so both of us really loved watching the two of them interact on there. I came into this with great expectations. I was buying a lot of the Seinfeld hype. And again, I see a lot of similarities to Seinfeld in its prime. It's not doing very well in its ratings spot on Sunday nights there, which seems to be kind of a death spot for me. But
yeah, I mean, I think that you may have just hit it. Yeah, I think it's time slot.
It's that, but I wonder, too, because I've seen some criticism, particularly coming out of the pilot, about Mulaney's delivery on this. And I wonder if that's not a little bit of Seinfeld aping there, because it seemed like, at least earlier on, that he was trying to do some of the same thing, enunciate the lines like it's part of your stand-up act. Think about Seinfeld, because he's my butler. It seemed like Mulaney was doing a little bit of that in the pilot, maybe not so much since then, and I haven't seen the criticism abate, but I haven't seen the ratings rise as much as I would like. What are you thinking at this point about what's going to happen with it, Lloyd?
Well, I think even from the moment that was shown at the Upfront, I mean, and ironically, was shown just a few blocks where Jerry Seinfeld lives at the Beacon Theater. This is, I think he's had this whole Seinfeld thing over him. And even if it's a fair comparison, the truth is Seinfeld's been off the air, what, since 1998? So somebody's willing to try that type of format again for 16 years later, I don't have a problem with it. I just think too many people in the media were going, oh, it's Seinfeld. Maybe because Seinfeld's on reruns like Gilligan's Island. I mean, it's just so ubiquitous that people haven't gotten a chance to forget and give this guy a fair shake.
Exactly. And Seinfeld is a strangely kind of timeless show for a show that doesn't obviously reference smartphones or any of the things we deal with today. If you can kind of strip that out, in a lot of ways, it really the plots seem as relevant as they did 20 years ago as far as the things that people are laughing about. And that's one of the keys to a truly, truly great show. Simon, what are your thoughts on this? Mulaney, again, when you're looking at creative people in the industry, highly touted, somebody who was very successful on Saturday Night Live on a critical basis. A lot of the writing that he did for Bill Hader and so many other characters was just so highly praised. It was kind of thought to be weird that NBC took a pass on his show. Lorne Michaels obviously is a big backer of his and is executive producer of the show there. Given all that of the potential that Mulaney has personally, that the project has, what are your thoughts about how much of a leash they're going to get?
Well, first of all, I saw John in concert at the Gramercy Theater in Manhattan the week before Fox premiered the show. And I was very impressed not only with him, but his supporting cast. I think they are all very funny. I think Mulaney has a great style. It is nowhere near Jerry Seinfeld's style or his approach to comedy. And I think he had some really good bits. I love his bit about Family Feud. I think it's the best routine about Family Feud you'll find from any comedian so far. I think two mistakes were made here. Mistake number one on the producers was to go the Seinfeld route rather than maybe make it a sketch comedy, maybe make it John playing off his fellow comedians kind of thing. I think if they had not done so many Seinfeld similarities where the audience either winking or trying hard not to wink, it might have had a better shot in terms of the actual execution of the show. Where I also think Fox made a scheduling mistake was putting it on Sunday night opposite Sunday Night Football and everything else and The Walking Dead and putting it on and breaking up the animation domination block.
Bingo.
Fox has established itself for years. It's at the tail end of the block. Brooklyn Nine-Nine is on like an hour before. Both are not doing well. I think the audience was so accustomed to watching The Simpsons and Bob's Burgers and until recently American Dad, now on TBS. I think it comes off as a shock that after the animated shows, here comes a live-action show. It doesn't ring compared to the rest of the format, which is football, the 7-8, or the overtime show, the wrap-up show of NFL football, and then the animation from 8-10. It just didn't ring. And I think the execution, so that plus the execution of the show, I think, hurt.
No question.
Could not agree more.
Yeah, no question. I it's funny how, and Rick, we're all sports fans, you know, when a team like changes its radio station, it takes about a full season for you to stop getting in the habit of turning to the old station first. And I think that's how it is with this particular situation. People on Sunday nights, you think Fox, you think cartoons or animation. That's it. End of story.
And incidentally, American Dad, which moved to TBS, their early ratings are solid. About 2.5 million people were watching the opening episode of the new season on TBS, and similar, it's going pretty well on that note.
You know, Rick, I'd like to. You mentioned Saturday Night Live, and if I could steer the conversation that way, this is, you know, the big 40th anniversary, and that's the one show I have been able to catch quite a bit. You know, with the whole new, a lot of new cast members and whatnot. I really just kind of want to get your take on it, Rick. With your thoughts, and obviously yours, Simon, and I'm happy to jump in as well.
Yeah, I haven't been as big of an enthusiast in recent years, but it seems like the new cast has some promise, but it's just. I don't know what you guys think about this, but it's just kind of an odd coincidence and I guess a sad one. And the things that make you think about some of the glory days of the show, the very sad passing recently of the criminally underrated Jan Hooks. And when you think back to just the core of that ensemble, many would say, maybe myself included, the best that they ever had. It's been tough to get these more recent ones to kind of live up to that. You get some sporadic performers here and there that you look at them and say, yeah, pound for pound, they're as good as some of the greats of the past. But that's kind of a sports analogy type thing to say, isn't it? To compare the great athletes of the past. We tend to do that And again, my sense is it may take a while for these guys to get out of the shadow of some of the greats, not even necessarily the ones from the last couple of years, because I don't think we've had anybody emerge, you know, that would be on the Mount Rushmore of the show in the last decade or maybe 15 years. What are your sense of it, Simon?
Yeah, you hit it on the nose. Saturday Night Live has sort of been rebuilding itself over and over again for the last decade because people have gone away, like a season or two. There's no cohesiveness between the not ready for primetime players. It seems that people are like dropping out, dropping in, coming aboard every season. And certainly it is the case with the 40th anniversary. However, keep your eye on Michael Che. I've seen this comedian in person. I think he is fantastic. If they use him great, I think he could be a superstar.
Well, there's always guys in there that have that kind of potential, Lloyd. Hopefully he'll be one of them.
Well, yeah, I think there has been one guy you can put on the Mount Rushmore. I think that's the guy you just mentioned, Bill Hader. I think he certainly always reminded me of a modern-day Dan Aykroyd, a very funny guy who played toward the intelligent side of comedy. I mean, when he did his Stefan bit, even if you knew the jokes were coming, you couldn't stop laughing. And that, to me, is a sign of a guy who's a home run hitter.
Mm-hmm. He was very, very good, no question about it. Now, as polarizing as the guy that I'm about to mention is to a lot of people, I'll say Andy Samberg as well. I've enjoyed that guy. He's always consistently made me laugh. I understand a little bit of him goes a long way for a lot of people, but count me among the people that are his fans. When we're talking about trends in TV, I certainly wanted to get to this as well. Simon, you mentioned early on about the amount of rope that is being given to the S.H.I.E.L.D. project on ABC because of, obviously, the tie-ins with the parent company and the wishes to monetize that. And while it may be doing weaker than people think, we are nevertheless in the midst of kind of a remarkable moment of comic book and superhero characters on TV and the attempt to promote that to a modern audience, this movement that's really kind of come up in the last 2 to 3 years that's taken off. How much more do you think it has in terms of legs?
Oh, plenty more. Plenty more, because comic books, you know, cover a wide range of ground. And the number one dramatic show right now on television is AMC's The Walking Dead, based on a graphic. If you take print and graphic novels, the sky's the limit. There are so many good graphic novels, comic books, comic stories out there, you can't run out. And there are so many comic book publishers and graphic novel publishers out there, and they're, like, just running all over the place. I think The Walking Dead, by the way, has gotten off to a sensational start. 17 million people saw the premiere of season 5. Add in the DVR, another 5 million. Amazing, amazing turtle. Who would have thought that a zombie show would have gotten anywhere near that kind of audience in prime time? But you're seeing it. We have Constantine now on NBC. The Flash, I mentioned, which is off to a terrific start for the CW, their best performing show in recent years. We have Z-Nation, by the way, speaking of, even though it's not based on a comic book, Z-Nation on Sci-Fi is turning out to be a popular new show on Friday nights after SmackDown. And we're going to keep seeing more and more of it. Incidentally, on a show I did earlier for Tomorrow Be Televised, I mentioned that there another source of TV material is movies, recent movies. According to The Wrap, the online entertainment site, there are 27 films from Ghost to The Truman Show to Minority Report that are attempting to be made, Rush Hour, they're attempting to be made into television series, and many more to come.
That is, that's really, really interesting, and I want to pivot to Lloyd to see if he has the same reaction to what you just said as I do, because Lloyd, when I hear that explanation, which makes a lot of sense to me about dipping into the vast pool of what's out there in terms of creative material, comic books, graphic novels, etc., I'm almost struck the same way that I am whenever the subject off the blast off into the stratosphere of Stone Cold Steve Austin in 1997. People talk about, oh, a character for its times. And I think to myself, a blue-collar guy drinking beer, fighting the boss, that could have worked in the 80s. That could have worked earlier. What kind of took everybody so long to get to that point to latch onto a character like that? Of course it was going to take off whenever it happened. And I sort of have the same reaction to what Simon just said. A lot of these materials have been out their readers for a long time. Kind of makes you wonder, why wasn't TV doing this 5 or 10 years ago?
Well, I have another theory on that. I call it the growth of the Comic-Cons. In a world where TV audiences are super fragmented, Mm-hmm. Rick, I don't know if you've been to any of these Comic-Cons. I've been in San Diego.
Not yet.
I was just at the one in New York. And they lend themselves to, you know, for niche audiences. You can bring in your talent to these panels, and I'll tell you, the buzz gets out very quickly. It's unbelievable how devoted these fans are, and how easy it is to market. I mean, it's when you go into the Javits Center or the San Diego Convention Center, you think you've walked into the National Association of Television Producers and Executives, the NAPI, where you see every batter, every network, and the mix, the combination of licensing, the combination of diehard consumers. I mean, it is absolutely a TV executive's dream. And I have a feeling that has accounted for a lot of the reason why you're seeing these type of comic books coming to life. It just lends San Diego probably New York more so than San Diego. San Diego has become a full entertainment convention, but New York, no question, it's that type of comic book novel come to life that you're seeing.
Yeah, and also on the executive level, nobody mm-hmm. is scared of science fiction anymore. There was a time when science fiction was the kiss of death. It was considered kiss of death. It was considered low rated. It was considered if we put it on, we have to meddle with it. The creators were concerned because of interference by the higher-ups at the studio or the production company or the network. And that's why, for example, the revival of Twilight Zone did not go. That's why other shows were like stuck in mid-gear. But no longer the case. They see that the audience, as Lloyd said, is so fragmented that science fiction series can be supported, and they can be done with the creators involved. And with a higher level of execution, of course, all the technology with special effects and so on, character-generated animation, et cetera, you can do practically any green screen. You can do practically anything.
Well, that's an excellent explanation by both of you guys in terms of why some of these subcultures are being allowed now to thrive on the big stage. I tend to agree with your reasoning as you guys put it out there. I didn't even intend this, but it serves to be a nice segue into what was my final agenda item for the night. I wanted to take a look at this because as I was going through my notes beforehand here, Simon, it occurred to me that right about 5 years ago, you and I had a conversation on the show, and we were doing a lot of looking ahead to the next decade segments on the show, and you joined for one dedicated segment dealing with TV and technology. So we're halfway through to the 20-teens at this point. And my sense of it is when you look at the integration of TV and the internet, when you look at us moving towards being an on-demand world, there's been a lot of strides, obviously, between the end of 2009 and where we're at now. In my mind, less than I anticipated, and my sense is that we're going to probably end the decade with less of this sweeping revolutionary change than we might have thought 5 years ago. Things may take a little bit slower to reach that point. What's your sense as we're halfway through it?
I'm going to beg somewhat, Rick, to disagree. I think one of the big stories this decade is the smart television set. It is the ability of a television set to let you watch your favorite shows and networks, the internet, the entire internet, not just web video, not just the internet, not just Netflix and Hulu, but Priceline, but Yahoo, but MSN, but TripAdvisor.com, and use those websites on your television set to download stuff from your smartphone or tablet and put it on the TV set, as well as to use original interactive apps. I think the American public is catching on. Every TV set maker has these sets out there. Not only that, you can control what you watch with your voice, with facial recognition, maybe body language. Your smartphone or tablet becomes a remote control. You can play video games. And we also have Roku, we have Chromecast from Google, which has been, I think, a big hit. We have Amazon Fire TV and now the Fire Stick, which is doing better than the Fire Phone, which is turning out to be a disappointment early on, at least for Amazon. And I think that's why Netflix and Amazon and so forth are doing very well. The people are watching it on the television set, not on the personal computer. I really believe that we are just beginning to see the capability of these sets and how you can control them, how you can work with them, how you can utilize them. I think we are on the verge of a major shift in terms of how we watch and use television, and the smart TV set is the catalyst.
That's very intriguing, and before I pivot to Lloyd, I want to ask you a follow-up question, because again, both of you guys are there in the East Coast corridor, greater New York area. I'm here in flyover country in greater Cleveland, so maybe my perspective's a little bit different on this than yours. Do you get the sense that even when you're talking about the vast hinterlands of the country in between the coasts, such as what I'm in, do you get the sense that there's been as much adaptation of this technology as you would have thought 5 years ago?
If it is, I think it's more quiet than it ought to be. I think if people are doing it, they're not buzzing about it, at least not yet. I think the TV set people are, along with the fact that ultra-high definition is also out in the marketplace. But I think that's going to change as more and more people get accustomed to it. I do talk to website people, and they do tell me, hey, I'm seeing people are watching Facebook on the television set. They're watching blogher.com on the TV set. And I think as the public weans into this, I think ultimately we're going to see more and more people make the buzz. And by quiet, I mean, for example, while you may not hear a lot about Roku, the fact is 10 million people now have a Roku streaming stick or a set-top box in their home, and they're getting 1,600 channels, and they're playing video games. Amazon is not saying how many people are buying Fire TV, but a lot are, to the point where now you have a Fire TV stick. And Google just announced Chromecast that they've had 650 million views of Chromecast over the last year and change, about 300 million in the last few months. So something is up, and people are paying attention.
Okay. And I thought that might perhaps account for our difference in perspective from my guess to your admittedly much more educated opinion on what's happening with this here. Lloyd, what do you think about what we were just talking about as far as the adaptation to the new technology, integration of TV and internet, the increasingly on-demand world that we live in right now, such that, for example, sports rights fees have basically skyrocketed because they're perceived to be the one thing that's DVR-proof. Have we seen as much change in these areas as you might have perhaps anticipated 5 years ago?
You know, the answer is yes. And I mean, I have to agree with Simon on some point. Yes, I have my HDMI cables, and we attach it from the computer to the TV. But you know what? Part of that reminds me, and I only do that for maybe selective stuff, but it reminds me of 3D television. People didn't want to wear the glasses. Remember? That was a complete flop. Now, I'm not saying that what Simon's saying is not accurate, but I think for it to become as mainstream, no cables. It's got to be the kind of thing that's almost automatic. You turn on the remote, and you can get your internet. You can, simple, no, what I call, no electronic gymnastics. It's got to be nice and simple. That basically anybody, any Luddite, including yours truly, just hits a button, and okay, now we're on the internet or whatever. Until that happens, if you're still playing with cables and boxes and this and that, I just don't see it. At least not mainstream. It'll always be the 10 million, but I don't see it ahead of a country of 300 million. I don't see that being taking over until that happens. Where, you know, it reminds me of the early days. Rick, did you ever study, do you remember the early days of computer science? I don't know if that rings a bell at all to you, but I remember taking classes. Remember Fortran, that language? And you had, you know, if somebody said to me, and I was 20 years old, 1977, I remember typing those cards, and if you made even one key punch error, and you had to take like 50 deck of cards and put it into a machine and have it, and this was computing, computers would never have taken off if that were the case, if that's what you had to do. It's not until you did the old point and click that suddenly personal computers took off. So Simon's right, but it can't be whether I got to attach my HDMI cables, and I got to do this. I need a Roku box. I need a, because, yes, there'll be always, you know, those on the cutting edge will do that, but it's too much work for the average consumer, like 3D television. I'm not putting my glasses on.
And Lloyd, you hit something there, which is, and this is where I agree with you on, is that the capability of these sets, the capacity of these sets has to get better. And so does the process by which the American public can use them. And that's where I think the smartphone and tablet can come in, because you can use that smartphone or tablet as your joystick or as your remote control. I really think that is going to become a major, major tool to controlling television and to utilizing it in all sorts of ways. And I can tell you there are a lot of projects on the board which are going to, I think, make the TV set a much more, I think, usable experience, whether it's Comcast X1 or X2 that's rolling out to their subscribers around the country, whether it is new ventures like C-Space or MaxMyTV. They've gotten about to get crowdfunding to make their ventures happen, which you use the smartphone or tablet or remote control in an easier way, or somebody coming up with that app that opens the door up. At some point, I think the press has been quiet to spot the trend here. But at some point, if something breaks loose, I think they will have to jump on board. Maybe
absolutely.
I think it will come before Apple decides we're going to finally do a TV set.
Yep, and it's fascinating to watch all of this coming together because we've been tracking this technology on the program for many years. Again, with you as our primary analyst in that regard, Simon, we've been very fortunate to be able to do that with you. It's always great to be able to break down TV and entertainment with this crew that we have here. Again, my good friends, Simon Applebaum from Tomorrow Will Be Televised, Lloyd Carroll from the Queen's Chronicle, Good Times Magazine et al., my good friends, FDH Lounge dignitaries. Gentlemen, thank you so much for yet another great TV and entertainment roundtable. Look forward to catching up with you fellows again sometime soon.
It's our pleasure. Thanks, Rick.
You got it, Rick. Thank you, Lloyd. Let's do this again soon. Take care.
You got it. Bye-bye.
All right. Thanks very much, fellows, and thank you all for tuning in today. Everybody, the mini episode number 484 of the FDH Lounge.